Right. So, just I will start to talk on time. In the meantime, Remo is adjusting the last details. We have three talks. The one that's coming now, it's obviously here, after the largest known prime numbers. That sounds interesting. There is a interesting box in the back, the Sun T2000. Bring me fond memories. I bought the first one in New Zealand. Now sounds too old, and it was, I don't know, January 2006. So, and then we have another presentation of James Reynders from Intel about how to teach parallel programming, which, in my humble opinion, is a really interesting challenge about why this is so hard. You ready?
I think so.
So I need to shut up and just...
Let's do it. I've been very aware of time the last few presentations, so I'm setting a timer for 20 minutes out of my 25.
Fantastic.
We'll see how that works.
If it
just
works.
Lost.
Well, it shouldn't sound so... I don't know. Don't look at me. It's just my computer.
Yep. There
cool.
We are.
Go ahead.
Okay. Kia ora koutou. My name's Remo Williams. Come from the States from about 3 years ago, straight to Gisborne, and it is the image in the back of this slide that brought me here, and many other things, but I'll get to that in sort of a roundabout way. I'm going to talk about a few things that are rather diverse subjects. Some of them I'll dip into in more detail than you want, and I can go pretty darn fast. Some I'll slow down at where you'd like, but I've got 100 slides. And if you can do the math like I can, those aren't going to fit in the remaining 22 and a half minutes. So, without further ado, I'd like to first thank off my current employer, Tairawhiti Polytechnic in Gisborne, who recognized the importance of Linux and open source and wanted to bring me down here for this. And thanks, Nicholas, for putting this on. Only being here for 3 years and starting off with a Polytechnic, now tutoring there, it's kind of... a bit disconcerting to see my face slapped around all of Gisborne with Polytechnic stuff, but that is currently the front page of the Polytechnic.
That's a joke.
That's not a joke. That is the front page. There's radio ads going, so every time I hear them, I kind of hide a little bit. And newspaper articles, they're doing this whole recognize the people in it, and this is one of the people in it. Hello. But first,
I'm sorry, and that was Creative Commons?
For today's purpose, it is all. I'm going to go back a few years, though, to when I got into computing. Actually, a little bit further than that. But in the mid-80s, I was doing computing for academic computing services in Boulder, Colorado. And I was a computing advisor working with all kinds of systems, from the brand new MS-DOS systems to System 5, BSD, Ultrix, VAX-VMS. We had a Cray off at NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research. I did stuff with NBS, National Bureau of Standards, which is now National Institute of Standards and Technology. It has the atomic clock for the world sitting there ticking away. I've been exposed to a lot of computing over my years that really does emphasize the need for open source, different computing environments, different architecture. It's such a shame when I see people getting stuck in one particular element, one operating system, whatever specific areas they get stuck in, it's going to keep on evolving. One place where I ended up in the mid-90s doing my master's research in electrical and computing engineering was the Artificial Intelligence and Simulation Lab at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And that really brought a passion to me about connecting all these different computing systems together. And I worked a lot with distributed object computing, heterogeneous computing environments, and ways of tying them together, especially in this realm for modeling and simulation. Started getting into research with CORBA, the Common Object Request Broker architecture, and ways of connecting machines together when you can define factories of objects, and you can define ways that the objects need to work together. CORBA, as with any system, can get a little bit overweighty and top-heavy with all of its abstraction layers. So I did some comparisons of direct socket to socket transfer and communications between systems, very low level and higher level with CORBA. And I was pleased to find out with larger objects, all of the overhead really blended in, and it was a viable architecture for many applications. Where my research started heading was into a world of using CORBA to implement high-level architecture as a modeling paradigm. I was very intrigued with this from a technological standpoint, but I found that most of HLA, the high-level architecture, was based on building distributed, federated simulations for the purpose of defense. Department of Defense-funded contracts really paved the way for a lot of the HLA stuff. And that's not really where I wanted to go. In fact, that's part of why I'm here in New Zealand, because that's not a path I'm interested in. It did bring to light a lot of ways of distributing graphics, though. And I found that where I wanted to head to with distributed object computing was much more in the fun areas, if you will. Computer graphics, Hollywood special effects, so on, all the good things. And so I started my quest for where to go next. And after, sending resumes here and getting a response, I said no thank you some other time. Sending resumes there and getting a response saying no thank you. I did get one from Weta. This was in 97, saying, yeah, we'd love to have you come on down. And that was great, but we don't have funding yet for our next film. Ah, okay, so that wasn't it yet. But I was hoping that still someday I would end here. Where I did end up is a place in Venice Beach called California called Digital Domain. This is an example of an HLA, a visualization and a synthetic natural environment, much like what I was working on and much like what I didn't want to support too much more. Instead, I wanted to support the dangers of the Governator. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Terminator. Digital Domain had just finished doing Titanic. I'll tell you a little bit about that. I did not partake in the creation and rendering of Titanic. I just got to use some of the equipment, and that was very, very cool. I did get to participate in some films there. I came in at the end of What Dreams May Come, so I got to experience my first Academy Award special effects Oscar party. Pretty mind-blowing, just like the special effects. Got to help turn Terminator 2 into a 3D ride, if you will, at Universal Studios, T2 3D. That was very, very cool. Lots of very cool stuff. But today we're talking about the very cool hardware, the very cool software, the very cool things you can do with it. These happen to be representative of the Silicon Graphics beasts that we had at Digital Domain. The SGI, we had Challenges that had 28 CPUs, Onyx stations, Monster Reality nodes, and they're not cheap. SGIs are not something that you used to have in your home. Some of you these days may, and that's such a nice treat. But back then, you couldn't really afford to have those around. And when they started considering for Titanic the amount of rendering and processing power they would need if using entirely SGIs, they realized that, like Titanic, it wouldn't quite work. So Daryl Strauss, my software manager, in charge of software development at Digital Domain, he and his mate Wook put together a few DEC Alpha CPUs. They had, in addition to the 350 SGIs sitting around, 200 DEC Alphas. A few of them were allocated towards Windows, that other operating system that was sitting across the street where they did TV commercials. Whereas in the main building, we used SGIs for the real films. Unix for film, Windows for TV. Question? The ads in films are much more expensive. Yep. I realize I think time is already halfway through. That's Daryl Strauss right there, and that is a sneak peek into the render farm that he put together.
Okay.
105 DEC alphas running 433 megahertz CPUs each. Whopping 433 megahertz. And back up a page just to remind you the rest of all this. 100 megabits per second. We did have a HIPPI network in there, so we're some pretty fast connections. But that's a lot of machines and 5 terabytes of disk space. At the time, that was a lot of disk space. Now you can get terabytes in Dick Smith. Just carry terabytes around in your pocket. There were lots of issues that Daryl and Wook ran into in putting together this render farm, and I won't go into all of them. In fact, I won't go into much except just to leave a couple quotes that talk about how they couldn't have done it without open source. Contrary to common sense, to build the best secret proprietary software, because in Hollywood, every particular effect is secret. It's all proprietary. Digital Domain was brought in for their Liquid Metal to do so many music videos, Busta Rhymes, Janet Jackson. People wanted that Liquid Metal look. When the Terminator melted away and came back, that's what they wanted. So it's not an open source effects system, but the need to have an open source technology behind it was very understood. So you need to have an open source platform underneath it. The reason is that proprietary software can require tweaks to the operating system itself that no proprietary operating system vendor would be interested in implementing. Sweet as. With open source, studios can throw programmers at anything, whether at the software or operating system level. And Linux got its big Hollywood break in 97 when Digital Domain used Linux to render the special effects for Titanic. And in 2003, this article goes on to say how easy it is that Sony even can install 100 Linux Intel render farm servers, have them up and running in an hour. That was then, and we've gotten even better. Even today, from one of their latest films, 2012, the quote is, "It's been our experience that open source projects help a lot, because typically in feature effects we end up needing to work very differently than the original intentions behind libraries." And that's what we all know here, being an open source. We need to change things sometimes. We need to adapt them, and open source does give us that flexibility. Well, somehow there was a turn. Somehow I ended up from doing space and science fiction movies such as Supernova to actually working on science. And that was a treat as well. Inspired by some of the cluster work at Digital Domain and some of the render farming that we got to do. And question? Thank you very much. The question, if I may, was that even though the effects systems may be proprietary, are there ever submissions back to the open source community of some changes? And I'm happy to say that Digital Domain does take pride in that. They do submit changes to open source graphics libraries, and they do make some of whatever they can available through GPL. Very good about that. Yes, thank you. So right on to Mars at the Lunar and Planetary Lab in Tucson, Arizona, where I spent quite a few years working on a project based on the 2001 Mars Odyssey, a spacecraft that was launched in 2001 and is still to this day orbiting Mars, and right now is listening for the heartbeat of the most recent Mars mission, the Mars Phoenix Lander, also launched by my same group. Was a part of that. It's been idle over the Martian winter because there hasn't been enough sun, and they don't expect it to be alive, but as the Odyssey is orbiting around, it's listening for a heartbeat as the sun comes over the Martian horizon to start bringing it to life again. So hopefully we'll start hearing some more science and data collection coming from that again, but it's probably dead. It was only allowed 3 months, or expected to be 3 months on the Martian surface, and it lasted 5 months, and then it went to winter. But we'll see what happens with that one. If time exists, which I don't expect, Got about 10 minutes, 6 minutes. I've got a video I can show of the 2001 Mars Odyssey launch. I'll just point it to you really quickly right there. There's the Odyssey as a spacecraft, still orbiting Mars, 3,010 days out now. That's the spacecraft itself. My team worked on the gamma ray spectrometer, which was set out from the boom so that it didn't get any of the gamma rays from the spacecraft itself. Wanted to isolate that and just travel around the planet and watch what gamma rays are emitted from the planet. Now, I'm not a scientist who studied gamma rays. I'm not a geochemical expert of any sort. But that's one of the beauty about technology, about working with computers like this, is that we can help scientists. We can help solve problems of many different natures, of which we may not always know, but we certainly get to understand. I learned a lot about GRS at the time, and it's a tricky problem because it's a passive sensor that goes over, and it just detects all of the gamma rays that the standard galactic cosmic rays hit, spark a nuclear reaction, basically, as what happens on Earth. All the gamma rays are popping up around us, and you can't really say if you get one gamma ray where it's coming from, because they're all coming from different angles. So the next 70 slides that I'll try to go through in about 70 seconds are from a presentation I gave in 2006 at the Moscow Space Research Institute with our partners at ICI, doing the high-energy neutron detector. And this is about our MCNPX cluster. MCNPX, what's that acronym? There's so many acronyms around. Well, MCNPX itself is a Monte Carlo simulator, Monte Carlo in particle extended. And it's got all kinds of things that you can define, such as the geometry of the setup, how high up the spacecraft is from the surface, and how many surface depths we have, essentially mapping out what the soils are underneath a few meters below and the atmosphere above. And start defining things of what we think the chemicals are, what the chemical makeup of Mars, because Odyssey is trying to understand how Mars is made up, where the ice is, the frozen water, where the dry parts are, where the silicon is, where the iron is, all of these things that they can only tell by reverse engineering the data that they've gotten. So we throw in models of what we think the system is doing, what we think is on the surface of Mars and below the surface, and then we run those into our simulation and start comparing. Does it match up? Where doesn't it match up? And all kinds of stuff goes into play. We look at the data, the area of interest we want, but this is essentially what's happening in the surface. A cosmic galactic ray comes down, hits neutrons in a something and spatters something out to something else, and stuff comes out. How about that? So we're watching for the things coming out. And they each have their own signatures and representations of the data. But to the scientists who are running the simulations, all they see are a whole bunch of cryptic input to the simulation and a whole bunch of really cryptic output. And my job was to help them make sense of it and help running simulations. So I'm going to go really quickly through the tools that I put together to make it make a little bit more sense, using XML as input and CSVs as output, and help generate the files that go into all of the science that really come into calculating all this stuff to say, if the spacecraft is here, what are all the places it's getting to? And remember, being gamma rays and maybe not coming out as often, you have to go around the planet hundreds, thousands of times to start collecting enough data to really figure out what's in there. And the Martian year is about 2 Earth years. So to get a year's worth of data, 2 Earth years, another 2 Earth years more, here's where it gets into the parallel processing into the next 5 minutes. We started off taking our Monte Carlo simulation that took 3 hours on a PC to do 100,000 probabilistically oriented runs. Put these on to a cluster on our local computing system, our computing center for the Polytechnic, and it had CPUs of 1, 4, 8, 16, 32, or 64 in alpha cluster. But we ran into all kinds of problems with it. Essentially, each person was only allowed one job at a time, and it would kill the jobs after 24 hours, but we sometimes had batches of 5 weeks that we wanted to run, so how to put these into a system like there. Essentially, I created some self-monitoring, auto-relaunching scripts that watched what it was doing, figured out if there was enough time for the next thing to go, and so on. But ultimately, we had to build our own. It really had to be a system that we had control over for our own distributed simulations. And we could build something very cheap using, I love Oak Ridge's Beowulf-style stone supercomputer. Bring any computer and it'll keep on growing. What we did, instead of going with either of those, was put out a bid, had another company that we said, we want 32 CPUs, basically, and we want them all powered by Linux. Who can do it? So we put a bid out there, got another company to do it, Aspen Systems in Colorado, and this is the cluster that we ended up with. Now, one of my take-home lessons today is running Fedora Linux. We had balanced the time that I had to work on a system like that to build it together myself versus all the other things that the scientists need. And we said, okay, if we have somebody else build it, it'll all be good, right? It doesn't always work like that, just like we're talking with open source. You've got to have control over it. And with some of the cluster management software that they had, it would do things like if a temperature spike was detected and it had to shut down, shutting down in 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 3 minutes, oops, 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, 4 minutes, what? So we had a few changes to do, and I think I've got a couple minutes left. Ultimately, if you're designing and putting together your own system or using somebody else's, you are going to need the flexibility to get in there and make changes. You're going to have somebody who can help make changes, whether it's writing your own web-based job submissions or doing fixes in the kernel. Specific things with MCNPX that we ran into is that the MPI that it was using was a little bit older. It was using an mpitch. I forget the version right now, and I don't have that in there. But there were a few disconnect problems in the middle of the night when there were a few conflicts with stuff, and I'll talk to you more about that later if you'd like. But essentially, by having our own cluster, we were able to take a 3-hour processing job down to 5 minutes to 10 minutes with 30 CPUs running at the same time. And there's some views of the cluster in action, some ideas about how to take a communication heavy system and re-parallelize it, redistribute it in a way that's much more efficient. You'll find every system has its little weaknesses and its holes and its bottlenecks. In some of this MCNPX, it's the communication, set up various job batches and so on, and lots and lots of stuff. So that's Bill Boynton, my boss, who's still in charge of lots of fun rocket science at the University of Arizona, simply saying there's a lot of water there. And NASA's philosophy is to follow the water. It leads to human exploration in space and so many wonderful things, so I did. Living in the desert of Arizona, studying the dry Martian planet, I really need some ocean back in my life. And I saw this Tirafiti Polytechnic ad sitting on this image right here. That's the water I was going to follow, I said. And that was 3 years ago, and I'm so glad I'm here, and I would not turn back around at all. I love some of the research they've done, but in this conference this week, you get to hear about some open source space research we can do right here in New Zealand as well. In the meantime, I've worked on an open source education project called EXE, sponsored by Tairawhiti Polytechnic, as well as Core Education, and started by the current Wiki Educator Projects man, Wayne McIntosh. If anybody of you know him, he's from Otago. Many open source projects going on here in New Zealand. Who's that guy? So now I'm teaching computing full-time at the Polytechnic, and I'm teaching beginning programming, and I want to introduce these parallel programming concepts. I want to introduce distributed computing. I want to introduce high-performance computing. And the way I'm doing it right now is in a very casual Friday afternoon hacking session. Good hat hacking, of course, but these are guys who are very motivated and not really confined to the curriculum. They don't want to do the set things. They've already done that. They want to do more, but they're in the Polytechnic setting, so I want to give them environments and tools like what we've been talking about today to really get them going to the next level. And there are so many places throughout New Zealand where cluster computing, high-performance computing, and parallel computing are already going. We've got a great foothold here. Let's keep it going.
Well done. And it was 100.
Yeah.
Well, I met Remo about, I don't know, 6 months ago, but I never figured out that you were a showman, too. Any questions, gentlemen, ladies, people, computers?
Yep.
No questions. Well done, Remo. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Our next presentation, the largest known prime numbers. And I bet that some of you already figured out some strange things at the back somewhere there. And there is even a small, I don't know, piece of glass that you need to use to watch actually the prime numbers. So, how many prime numbers do you know? I've been an entrepreneur all my life. My first venture was a mathematics academy, and I think that I still remember how to do square roots manually. That gives you an idea how old am I. And then we knew how to memorize prime numbers until 1,000, and even convinced kids of 12 years old to memorize that. So let's see what Rob comes out with that. Well, you need to... Done? Oh...
So I'm Rob Giltrap. Some of you may know me from my early days involvement in the Welly Lug. I kept it running for a few years in early 2000, founding member of the New Zealand Open Source Society. And I also work for Sun Microsystems as a systems and storage architect. But this discussion is really about my hobby rather than my job. And that hobby is searching for the world's largest prime numbers. And to do that, I've used a lot of Sun technology, and we'll get onto that. So what I'm going to cover here is a quick look at GIMP's project, which is the project involved in searching for these large prime numbers. Then the Lucas-Lehmer primality test, which is the real problem we're trying to solve, the code, the application to do and resolve the problem, the tools I used, and then the parallelization effort. And that was really because once I got hold of the code, though it was designed to run in a parallel manner, it hadn't actually been coded as such yet. So the GIMS project is basically the great internet VSN prime search. It is a distributed computing project. There's roughly 60,000 computers out there which are actively doing searches for these large prime numbers. There's about 35,000 registered users and about 260,000 actual computers registered, but only about 60,000 of them actually are actively giving results. And it's not a bad sort of supercomputer, putting it at 40 teraflops on average, and that's slowly increasing over time. The project has found a bunch of Mersenne prime numbers, and I'll tell you exactly what these are. For those who don't know, Mersenne prime is a specific type of prime. It's basically where 2 to the power of a prime number minus 1 is also a prime number. That is called a Mersenne prime. They're very rare, but they're quite interesting in terms of really getting into the large number space. Also have correlations to perfect numbers as well. For every Mersenne prime, there is a correlation to a perfect number. And they've been around a hell of a long time. First documented in 5th century BC. Quite a lot was written about them by Euclid in 300 BC. But, you know, the first two were found in the 5th century, the next two were found in the 4th century, and then there was a pretty big gap after that, through the Dark Ages, we got to number 5. So there's only 12 discovered before the advent of computer processing. And if you can see, there's a sort of thing down the back there where I've got the largest one known before computer processing, the largest one involved with computer processing but before distributed computing, and then the largest one, which is with the assistance of distributed computing. That one, the number's very, very large, and you actually need a little thing to look through to actually see the digits. So, but I urge you to take a look, because it's quite interesting. So there's now 47 have been discovered. The name Mersenne Prime comes from this guy, Marin Mersenne, who was a French monk. Pretty interesting character. Actually, the fact that his name got associated to the Mersenne Primes is bizarre, because he really didn't do that much about with them, and there's plenty of other people whose names could have been associated with them. He's actually more famously known for being the father of acoustics. He did a lot of the initial maths around chord structures. So for everyone who, you know, plays the guitar, you've got a lot to thank this guy in terms of understanding the science behind how acoustics work. But the thing I found most interesting researching him was that he was what I consider, you know, semantic web version, the very first alpha version. He would go out and write to all the scientists throughout Europe and say, give me some information on what you're working on. I'm going to be doing this to lots and lots of other people, and when I find the bits which they've got of interest, which you may be of interest in, I will forward it on between you all. Not only that, he would translate it. So he would have a little team of his fellow monks who are fairly educated and spoke a variety of languages, and they would go out gathering bits of data from the scientific web out there, taking it in, working what was relevant to other parties, translating it, pushing it out again. A fantastic guy, and it's just like, wow, what could have he achieved in today's society with the technology available to us today? So back to the actual problem we're trying to solve, and that is saying, okay, well, how do we just find these large prime numbers? Well, we know a lot of the smaller prime numbers. We know them all sequentially, so we can just take one and do the process, 2 to the power of p minus 1. Is that a prime? Well, how do you actually work that out? Well, you can do old school maths and say, let's just divide it by every sort of odd number up to the square of the total number, but that will take forever. It's actually the first bit we do go through that process to rule out some of the things. So we take the large number, divide it by 3, you know, is that wholly divisible, yes or no? Okay, is it potentially a prime, yes or no? But the real way of doing it is using the Lucas-Lehmer test, which is here. Now, for those of you who didn't do too well at maths, it's actually a fairly simple equation with a little bit of research, fairly simple to understand. And the key part of it is the squaring. Computational-wise, it's the squaring which takes the time. Trouble is, when you're doing squaring really large numbers, it's extremely problematic. So we use what we call a fast Fourier transform. Now, the maths involved in that is actually really, really hard and way above my head. Fortunately, I don't need to understand it to get the code running fast. So, and the person I deal with is this guy, Ernst Mayr. He's in California. Really interesting guy. He, mathematician, understands the whole maths behind it really, really well, but he also works for various companies doing CPU design. So he's got sort of the best of both worlds and knows how to write a program to get the most out of the CPU and vice versa. There are three main programs out there which do this work, and that is Prime95M Prime is the one which the general populace use to just say, you know, I'll download it onto my computer, it'll go get a number, it'll start processing it, you know, 6-8 weeks later, months later, it'll return a result. That's runs on Windows and Linux, and is primarily written, the core of the code is written in assembler to really get the speed, and you know, runs just on Intel, AMD x86 platforms. GLucas is written in C, and it's can obviously, being written in C, it's more, can run on various platforms. Key design there is that it's fine-grained threading, and then MLucas is the one which I've been working on, and that is more of a coarse-grained threading model. Now, the reason why people don't just use the top one is that that is, doesn't scale very well in terms of parallelism. So most people run, you know, they may run, if they've got a quad-core machine, they'll run 4 individual processors, each doing one number, rather than trying to take one number and carve it up, because it doesn't perform too well. Where the others are much better, more, they're handling parallelism. So it uses a custom FFT. There's lots of optimized FFT libraries out there, all wonderful, but when you're talking about the numbers, the size of the numbers we're dealing with, which is in the range of, you know, 12-13 million digits long, they just don't cut the mustard. So you've really got to have a specialised one. It's pure C, and we're starting to throw in a little bit of assembler in there, assembly, and that's just to do prefetch and the like. Trouble is, now to really get performance, you've got to go to another layer, and with the, certainly with the x86, you've got to start using ECC2 directly to really get the performance out of it. So, but this was originally designed for non-x86, so for your Alphas and your Sparks and those systems which did have, you know, the potential to have lots of CPUs in them. And the goal for it was really to have the fastest verification codes. That was, what happens was when these 60,000 computers are going out there finding primes and they're all processing one, and, you know, about every 18 months one comes up and says, oh, I think I've got one. An email goes out to about 6 people around the world, I'm one of them, and we all race to try and verify this new find as quickly as possible. Given that, you know, the PCs, the fast PC will process one number in about 6 to 8 weeks, people don't want to wait around that long, so we try and throw something a bit quicker at it to get the results. So, being that I work for Sun, and Solaris and Sun, you know, high levels of parallelism, it's just, you know, that's the ecosystem we work in. I thought, great, well, I'm in a perfect position to take this code and see what I can do with it. This is my hobby, and just my job gave me access, either officially or unofficially, to resources within the company. And there's certainly plenty of other people in the company who are interested in this sort of things, which were willing to help me out. In fact, plenty of senior managers were quite happy to say, hey, this is cool. Here's a multi-million dollar box, have a play for a while. So at Sun, we've got a bunch of hardware, which is really great. Lots of it with, lots of cores in it. We've got Solaris, Open Solaris, and that is synonymous with, you know, high levels of parallelism. And Sun Studio, which is something I never played with before having to do this. It's not part of my job at all. So on the hardware, we thought, right, well, where do we start? You know, what sort of hardware is going to be able to handle this highly parallelized workload well? And we got things like the AMD Opteron, which at the time was sort of ahead of Intel in terms of their high-end CPU. And that sort of box is, you know, today you've got eight CPUs, 6 cores per CPU, 48 cores. Plenty of juice there. The UltraSpark T series, that's really interesting. That's a cool thread technology, lots of slow threads, and you can get a box now which has got 4 processors, 8 cores per processor, 8 threads per core. So you're talking 256 threads in a box. And then you've got the traditional old big iron, with the Spark 64 processors. You can get a couple of racks, bolt them together, 128 processors, 4 cores per processor, 2 threads. So you're talking like 512 threads in a box. Massive throughput. I think it's 3/4 of a terabyte per second, between two boxes bolted together. Fantastic memory, terabyte of memory sort of size.
Sorry, I have the first prime number.
No, that's a unitary number.
We can argue about that.
How am I going for time? So I had plenty of hardware options to play with, and then Solaris. Well, Solaris, I'm a Linux guy just as much as the next person, but when it comes to scalability, I can't really go past Solaris. Just from the history which it's had, you had your large ETNK boxes with 64 processors, a decade ago. It's an operating system which is used to and familiar to having a lot of threads available to it. It's not something you have to sort of add on to, so it's actually a little bit easier on occasion to use this instead of Linux. Though, very, very similar. Particularly with when you're using this many cores, the operating system, you really just wanted to get it out of the way. Not try and do anything too smart. Benefit of Solaris, consistent across all the hardware platforms, so we have multiple types of chips, but we're all just planning for one operating system. The memory placement option of it is very, very good, and that was a key, it was a necessity for Solaris to be able to place memory more optimally because it was designed to be running on larger systems. It wasn't an add-on, it was just a core function. Observability of Solaris is very good with D-Trace and resource control, turn off threads, turn off cores, doing stuff very, very nice. Now, Sun Studio.
We are running out of time.
Am I? I'm very, very close to it, okay. So, Sun Studio, it's part of the Sun ecosystem, and Sun ecosystem is threads, 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 and there's lots of tools which you can use to use it. So the parallelization effort had the software design, but had the high access to the hardware, the tools to do it, but not the time to actually take that code and properly parallelize it, put in the OpenMP, do all the testing. So we got a Google Summer of Code project up and running, got a guy to do it for me, fantastic, did a brilliant job. Can't say enough about the guy who did the work. And we got some... Skip a lot there. So some of the tools, Sun Studio, thread performance. This is a situation where we had 4 threads going full out and the other one just only kicking in every so often. The tools which are available with Sun Studio are really, really good for analysing your problems. Arndale's law is absolutely key. What we found is that when a single-threaded process, we basically had a transform square, transform carry. As you start doing the first 3 bits, when you're only talking about a 2-core machine, not that much difference, but when you're talking 16 threads, the bit which isn't parallelized suddenly becomes a really big bottleneck. So we've got some challenges, big numbers, lots of hardware options, so lots of testing, and compilers can be broken. I've broken Sun Studio compiler 3 times using this, simply because we're pushing it to the edge of what's needed. Our end result was 12.3 times performance for 16 threads, which is pretty damn good. In fact, when we used 4 cores, we actually got a more than 4 times increase due to the cache effect. And the end result was that we were now the fastest code for verifying primes. And back in 2008, we were the first to validate a prime, the first one over 10 million digits, which was worth a $100,000 prize. So there's some useful links that'll go up on the website. And now our challenge now, taking it to, we could really only effectively work with 16 threads, want to take that to 40, prepare for 100 million digits, much bigger problem, and then it takes 2 years to process it. the 160 meg working set, we try to fit everything in cache. And finally, James will be keen to know that we are going to leverage Nehalem EX. It's proving to be an extremely powerful processor using the GLucas code. It's just taking us a while to get it going with the MLucas code. So,
thanks, Rob, and good luck.
Thank you.
Right. There is a couple of Open Solaris t-shirts here, which maybe Chris deserves one, definitely. Cool. And next speaker, James Reinders. And there is a small story behind teaching parallel programming, that it's how I actually came through James on the web. So I just found an experience that happened on Brooklyn Polytechnic or something like that in New York, about how these guys of Intel were simply teaching parallelization to high school students, probably Remo's dream. And then I say, well, that's interesting, and just click an email to James to say, well, this is happening in New Zealand, a mini conference, so would you like to come? And you say, January, New Zealand, I will be there. Simple like that. So assuming that apart from leaving, I don't know, the US and Canada with 15 below zero or something, I hope that you found other interesting things here in New Zealand. Go ahead.
Thanks, Nicholas. So I promised Nicholas that I'd make this quick and keep us on schedule so we can get to the panel and so forth. But yeah, I did overpack because I had to be in Toronto before this, so I've got tons of winter clothes that have gone to no use at all. I'm not complaining here. But as Nicholas said, I'm a big believer that teaching parallelism is something we need to integrate into, we need to move it out of graduate studies and into basic programming. In fact, quite common feedback I get from professors in undergraduate curriculums, at least when we first started talking about this, is there's no room to add a class. And I said, good, I don't want you to add a class. But when you're teaching data structures, how about you mention the challenges of concurrent access and protection around data structures and how that might affect your choice of data structures? Or when you're teaching state machines, teach that you might want to consider a program made up of multiple state machines that interact instead of always describing a program as a single state machine. So in any case, we got doing that, and somewhere along the line, I probably shot off my big mouth and suggested that we could even teach this to high school students. And the next thing you know, I got the opportunity to go with some friends and teach in Brooklyn Tech, which I had never heard of before, but it's the largest science math magnet school in the country, in the United States. It's an amazing place. We had a lot of fun. So I want to talk a little bit about that experience and also some thoughts about how to teach parallelism. So I think, to me, really a critical thing when you want to really understand parallel programming is I just abbreviate it as think parallel. I don't know how to describe it. That's any better than that. But when you approach a problem, if you're thinking about how you might take advantage of parallelism, where's the concurrency in the application that you're trying to do? Starting with that and having a vision for that is critical. I guess this is not unlike any type of computer programming. You're better off if you get start with a good design than you are if you just write some code and then try to design it later. Parallelism really does that. In fact, one of my favorite quotes some people say is, the old computers, we could run bad, even bad code would run faster on a faster processor if we cranked up the megahertz. But bad parallel programs don't run faster when you give them more and more cores. So this is a challenge. So I want to share some thoughts and resources about teaching some of the observations we've had in working with universities and teaching parallelism and with professionals as well. But like I said, I don't think parallel programming is just for graduate school anymore. And I think you could even do it in high school. And that's how Nicholas ran into me, was the press around the fact that we went and taught parallelism at a high school. Which, by the way, was really effective at getting university professors to drop us notes and say, how can we get involved with the university stuff? If we're already teaching high schoolers, they felt they might be behind. And that might have been one of our motives, me in particular. So we had 15 students and 6 teachers attend. It was a pretty small little group in the middle of the summer. These are the students that didn't get a job, so I don't know, but they were still pretty good. And if you're interested in the full agenda, I'll give you a link later for the agenda, but we started off talking to them about terminology, but we very quickly wanted to get them into some labs. So the labs, we actually did OpenMP, threading building blocks, and then on the last day, one of the guys involved with us, who's an IT, I shouldn't call him an IT manager, he's a very high up manager of computing resources at a Wall Street firm, a pretty well-known guy. He came in and talked about lock-free queue design and lost all the students' attention. It was way over their heads. It was kind of amusing to watch because on the first day they all thought that we were going too slow. But one of my fellow teachers started by asking them, and these students were not shy, who among you knows what task parallelism might be, or data parallelism, or what's a race condition? And he went through these basic terminology, 6 or 7 different things, and none of them knew any of them except one. I think there was one, like race condition, I think one student kind of had it right, and the other students couldn't improve upon the definition. So, and I learned these students were not shy if they had known this terminology. At the end of the 3 days, they knew all these terms, which is going to be a real important thing for them learning parallelism. They understood what scaling might be and data races, very basic things. But we did get them into programming and modifying some open source things that also we have referenced in our material. There's something called Destroy the Castle, which is a very graphical thing. Could be a game, and they were able to change it and add parallelism to it, so it was much more realistic in its rendering and its speed. But we had fun with that, and they were very impatient. I went back to my hotel that evening, we had set up a Facebook page for them, and some of them had joined it, and when you join a Facebook group that is set up by somebody, you effectively become their friend, and so I could see his postings, and next thing you know, there's a posting that says, multi-core class today was so boring. That's all he wrote. And then one of the other kids in the class liked it. I think I found that after the second day. I sent a note and said, well, I hope we did better on the second day. And he was a little embarrassed. He hadn't thought about this social networking that he would, suddenly one of the instructors would see it, but it was okay with me. And he told me, he says, I really just thought we were going to sit down and start writing a game as soon as we got into class. And he really did. He just thought, we're going to write parallel games. He didn't know what a data race was, scaling. He didn't know what OpenMP, threading building blocks, or any method was. He just thought we were going to start coding instantly. So anyways, anytime I tell this story to teachers, they go, and you were expecting what? So it was a blast. But we, at the end of the third day, it was really positive. They were excited. And I think they all left with something, a knowledge that will affect them. And they were all interested in programming. They left with things. They were active on our Facebook for a little while, posting notes back and forth, asking us questions. We gave them material. And after about a month and a half after they worked with us, they sort of disappeared out of sight. I've gotten a note occasionally from one of them asking some questions, but never any evidence that they've gone off and they're trying to write the ultimate parallel program yet. They all seem to be much more interested in becoming game developers. They somehow think that's going to make them multimillionaires. It's some students dream of being NBA stars. These guys all thought they were going to be the ultimate game writers and make millions. So in any case, I think they got a good experience out of it. Now, the teachers gave us real high marks, but in the United States, and I don't know if this applies elsewhere, but computer science is taught in a lot of high schools, but most students don't take it. I think the majority of students don't take that in high school before they go off to the university. but in what we would call a college prep school, a school where the students are generally going there to prepare themselves to go off to the university, they usually have a computer science class, and a lot of students take it. But lo and behold, there's these wonderful tests that we take called advanced placement tests that if you get a good enough score on them, you get to skip the first term or year of computer science at the university level. So getting a good score on the college AP exam, AP for advanced placement, is the goal of almost every computer science class in high schools. And it's about learning Java and basic programming ideas, and there's absolutely nothing about parallelism in it. And since we were encouraging them to teach students about an important topic of parallelism, they can quickly evaluate it and say it's not needed for the AP exam, so it's not going to make it into the class. So there was a little bit of talk about, well, maybe the last few days of the class, if the class goes longer, if they take the test, maybe we can tell them about it at the end. So that set up a bar. Now we are we're working with the ACM curriculum recommendations, and we're hoping that we can at some point change some of the curriculum recommendations. The curriculum recommendations for undergraduate computer science program doesn't even recommend parallelism as a topic right now, the ACM official suggestions. So if we could get that changed, maybe we can get the high school. Anyways, this was an interesting thing. But we've gotten queries, and I think there are teachers incorporating this at the high school level. But this AP problem, at least in the U.S., is a very big and real one, and there's no way we're going to convince a lot of high school teachers in the U.S. to teach parallelism because it's not on the, until it's on the AP exam. As soon as it's on the AP exam, they'll beat our doors down. So, now, I do have a URL. There's intel.com/software/academic, and I'll have this URL on a lot of my subsequent foils, but this is a place that we encourage professors to go to, or if you're interested in teaching in any form, sign up, and you can download material. It's really an exchange that we set up, and all the course material that we used in the high school is there. I'm not going to tell you that it's wonderful, beat-all, end-all course material. I would never say that, but it's I think we didn't even put it under Creative Commons. It's just take it and do anything you want with it. But it's an open source model, if you will, on here's what we did with teaching. Improve upon it if you like. Tell us if anything's good. A few notes. One thing that I think I would change, I would do differently next time, and I'm really enamored. I think the university program I'm most enamored with that I've seen in the world on teaching parallelism at an undergraduate level is at the University of California, Berkeley. Very first class, they go right into teaching MapReduce. And Professor Patterson, who really drove this, they do it in Scheme, which is a dialect of Lisp. And if you want to know the difference between Scheme and Lisp, you need to understand the difference between lambdas and closures. So we'll have to ask that earlier speaker to explain that. That's the fundamental difference between those languages. But in any case, MapReduce is it's a beautiful thing to teach, and it's really current. Students get excited because, hey, Google basically built an empire on MapReduce. And it gets you really excited at the potential of parallelism because MapReduce is enormously scalable, and you just kind of blissfully take the students through a term learning MapReduce, and they think the world's wonderful, parallelism's perfect. We'll tell them about scalability and things later. So it's really neat. They've written a paper about it. I have referenced here as well. If you search Berkeley looking for Scheme/MapReduce, something like that, you'll find this paper that they wrote about their experiences teaching this or their excitement. I really like that. See, even the computer is getting tired at the end of the day. Professor Patterson's very funny. I like this quote he gave in an interview a little while ago. We don't know what we need to teach exactly about parallelism yet, but we know we should be changing what we're teaching. I think they've done the most ambitious program to change things. Now, we have been working with universities for a number of years. We realized that with multi-core coming on, not only should we be working with professionals, developers, producing tools, working with companies, things like that, but we should take a look at what effect we could have with universities. And it turns out it's quite a challenge. Curriculums are set, changing them is often a little difficult, creating material for them, a professor has to teach a class all term. Some of them have developed material in labs. They did it 10 years ago, and they, you know, they keep teaching the class again and again. And getting new material, it takes time and effort. So we realized we had been trying to teach this to professionals and doing this, and that we could collaborate and help. And probably more importantly, we could create a community where people who were developing it could share with each other. This has been really quite popular, and we've got a lot of material there, course material, curriculum that professors and universities are using. We offer our software development tools free for use in classrooms, whether you're doing it on Linux, which is the most popular by far, or Windows or Mac. We've got tools for that, make those available for classrooms. And we have, I think I checked the website the other day, it was 1,711 universities around the world have at least one professor as a member of this community. That's quite a bit. India's a little overwhelming in the number of universities that are participating. They've been really excited. I think the combination there is there's an awful lot of universities in India, and they speak English, which helps. So they teach in English, and so there was a large draw there. China's a pretty big draw as well in the U.S., and we've got participants in, I think, 81 countries. So this has been, it's just a community, a lot of different exchanges, material taken, material posted. It's well worth a look. And there's lots of different categories in material here. It goes beyond just multi-core. There's been a lot of exchanges in different areas of course curriculum as part of this. And it's free to join. You join it so that you can post. It's just a pretty typical thing. And the material is attributed back to you. But people have been posting and exchanging things here for three years or so. It's really grown to be a very valuable resource. And we've got tools available to participants in the program. There's even some videos and interviews. There's a lot of video interviews with different people teaching parallelism, and it seems to be constantly growing. The guy Paul that does the interviews, he's got a bit of a wit, so some of them get pretty funny. And we've gotten really great feedback from quite a few people who have used this material. And generally, they take the material and change it to their own voice and their own needs, and hopefully post it again so that others might benefit from it. So, the program grew a bit after the news got out about us teaching high school students, but it had been growing pretty steadily, and I think it's a great resource trying to help university professors and teachers of different walks of life, or different types of teachers, get some basic materials they need, some ideas, and so feel free to join and participate. If you really feel strongly that there should be more Haskell being taught in schools, and you want to do that, you know, go ahead and promote it. I promise I won't go delete it right away. I can't say I won't post sarcastic comments, but in any case, that was just an overview, kind of a light end up the day thing. One other activity I'm involved in, and as Nicholas mentioned, if it weren't for me doing this, Nicholas wouldn't have run across the news article and invited me to spend the cold, brutal winter here in New Zealand instead.
Thank you very much, James. I will invite James and Lenz and Timo and Remo and, well, all the speakers who want to join us to just sit here. And I suggest to, when I proposed this idea to have a panel, and then later a burst of a feather I wasn't actually sure if the attendance will be more than a dozen of people. So actually, I thought I would be a round table between the presenters that I will hope that they will stay. Well, I'm extremely pleased to see all of you guys. And pretty much the idea is to answer this question and explore if the answer that I just wrote here will work. So I don't know how we will use the microphone story, if we share, or do you want me to use this? We don't have this one?
Yeah.
I use this?
Yeah, you use that. So pass that one.
And then could you please pass me more cable? So just sit here. And I also will encourage all you guys to just came a little bit closer, because you know how it is working. Every time that you pass this, the speaker is already say 10 words, which usually are the ones that say yes or no to the question, and then you miss the part. But why, you don't want to see me like that? Then, and yes, there is a, if someone can, yeah, cool. So essentially the topic of why parallelism is that, well, we have been writing, well, I haven't been writing code for 25 years, but the code has been written in a way. Now all these guys say, forget that. And even James mentioned David Patterson. He's a very charismatic professor in Berkeley. A character, either. I met him and had absolutely no idea, and then later I asked, hey, who is this guy? Did you meet Patterson? I said, well, I knew that he was a Rolling Stone or something like that. But the guy is out there saying that there is a lot of money to make in parallelism, for example. That excites me. So the question would be, why parallelism, and is open source, multi-core, New Zealand an answer for that? So I will ask.
Is open source, multi-core, parallelism in New Zealand an option? Is that the question? Is that what we're starting with? I think so. I think there's enough great stuff happening here already. Open source is very alive in New Zealand. Parallelism, cluster computing, high-performance computing, multi-core computing, it's all very alive here. I think it's a great starting place for it, and it just needs to keep on growing here. And I think if we can start teaching it early, that's the way to get it growing as much as we can, because being stuck in particular curriculums won't make that happen either. I don't know how we're going to do it, but I know that how we're doing it isn't the right way. How about that? Pass it on.
Well, for an effective panel, you normally want to find someone with a rebuttal, and I don't know. Am I supposed to say, no, New Zealand's not going to be able to do this? So, I don't know. Australia's probably, you know, going to be a part of it, too. How about that?
All right. Yeah, I'm from Australia. I'm from Melbourne. I don't think parallel, you can probably guess that I don't think we need to teach parallel programming to people, because I think the compiler should do it. But that means that you still need people to write the compiler, or experts to tune it and things like this, or to tell the compiler when it's wrong, because they don't always get everything right. We know that. I mean, we saw it today, somebody had a little bit of handwritten assembly to do the really performance critical bit. Yeah, so we still do need control, but yeah.
But what about Stephen? What sort of control are you?
What sort of? Well, yeah, I'm not quite. I'm not exactly sure what the question is, but I think people haven't quite twigged how important it is. Because the change in hardware is being thrust upon them, and people have not quite realised. So I think making everybody aware of that is an important thing.
Yeah, well, I think there is a divergence about to occur. We've had a convergence within chip design, where things like on-chip memory controllers have started off with Sun and other technologies, AMD, and now Intel's got it. So a lot of it has been converging, but I think we're getting to a point now where it's just not that easy to use the number of cores which are available. Some things you can do. I mean, I can install Apache and run up a web server and use a hell of a lot of threads, no problem at all. But to get other things like primes, my thing, going, it's very, very difficult. So I think you're going to have a divergence where you're going to have, James was saying, that you're going to have different sorts of cores on a chip, because you're just going to throw more and more functionality on there. There's also going to be chips where you're going to have 100 cores on them, and there will be programs which can easily make use of those. And I think that's where it's going to diverge. You're going to have a sort of consumer products which have a limited number of cores, and except for the graphics, which can parallelize very, very well. And then you're going to have cloud computing, which has massive number of cores which can be used.
Just a comment on what you say, and then there are at least one or two questions around. If it's hard to parallelize cores that homogeneous, will be even harder to parallelize different cores. So that's a question that. But first, from
yeah. So it seems to me like part of this divergence that's been talked about is a problem of education. Now we've already heard James talk about education, but I was wondering if there were any sort of specific Titan II approaches, for advocating, that universities, and more specifically high school, sort of catches up in sort of